Future-Proof Extra from News Talk.
Now, I think, or at least I hope, that we can all appreciate that the miracle of childbirth is pretty, well, miraculous. But while most of the animal kingdom lays eggs, we and almost all other mammals have taken a different route. Why? Well, Dr. Elsa Pancioli is research fellow at the Oxford University Museum of Natural History and author of Beasts Before Us, The Untold Story of Mammal Origins and Evolution. It was published recently. She joins me now. Welcome to the programme, Elsa. Yeah, in this intro, I said almost all other mammals have taken a different route. But before I was doing any research for this piece, I would have said the thing that defines a mammal is that they have live young. Do we have a very clear definition of what a mammal is?
Well, yes and no. I think if you ask most people what is a mammal, they'll say they're warm-blooded, you know, hot-blooded. They'll say that they have fur or hair, and that they give birth to live young. But actually, when we start looking back in time, some of those things begin to get a little bit fuzzy and a little bit unclear. So of course, in modern world today, we have mammals that lay eggs. We have platypuses and echidnas, they lay eggs. And of course, kangaroos and marsupials, they give birth to live young, but they keep them in a pouch. Whereas of course, we're familiar with the live birth that of course that humans have, where there is no pouch. And as we look back in time, we start to see that, you know, some mammals are actually, even now, some mammals are less warm-blooded than others. And of course, some of them lose their hair, and it begins to get just basically whatever rule you set up in biology, you could be pretty sure there's going to be a bunch of animals that very annoyingly break it for you. But those are the kind of general things we think of.
But how do platypuses qualify then? Why do we not just call them weird creatures as opposed to mammals? What makes them mammals if they're laying eggs?
That is an excellent question. A couple of things. I mean, as a paleontologist, the thing that I look for when I'm looking in the fossil record is their jaw joints, which that sounds really arbitrary and like, why on earth would that matter? But the thing, one of the things that mammals have that really defines them is that they have really complex teeth and can process lots of different foods as a result. And one of the things that's connected to that is the type of jaw joint that they have. So what we basically look for in the fossil record is which bone in the jaw, because in other animals there's lots of bones, not just one, meets which bone in the skull. And if it has this particular arrangement, we can say, yep, it's a mammal. If it doesn't, then it's one of the ancestors, one of the close relatives.
This reminds me of the bird hip and lizard hip of the dinosaurs. Why would we define an entire beyond species? What's the word for what mammals are?
We would use the word clade. Clade is what we would say. Yeah.
We would use the word clade. So mammals are is a clade of species, right? Why would we use the jaw? Why it doesn't make any sense.
So that is a really, really good question. Well, I mean, part of the problem is that there's 100 different things, as I said earlier, that we can look for. And some of them are things that we see in modern mammals, like warm blood, like producing milk. But how can we tell if a fossil does those things? We can't tell if they made milk. We can't tell, well, we can perhaps tell in some if they had fur, but they'd have to be exceptionally well preserved. So we can't look for those soft tissue features. We have to choose something in the skeleton. And there's been debate, of course, over the centuries since the sort of beginning of Western science about what thing to choose. And different people have chosen different points in, different characters, we would say, of the skeleton. But ultimately, that's the one that's been settled on. It's the jaw joint that would define actually what we would call mammalia forms. So it gets even more technical. I mean, I could go crazy with technical language, but
please
basically,
please,
yeah, I know nobody really wants that.
So let's take a few lily pad hops back through history and try and get an idea of where these mammals came from. So what would be the most logical next step if we think of ourselves as modern humans? What's the previous turning point for the mammalian line?
There are so many, and this is what makes it makes it difficult, particularly in the past, to tell this story simply. So this is what I've tried to do in the book, is to find a way of telling it that isn't hopping all over the place. So, I mean, really, we can trace our line back much further than you might think. So possibly some of the listeners out there might have heard in the past that mammals evolved from reptiles, for example. But we know now that that is absolutely not true, and that reptiles and mammals, they share a common ancestor, but that ancestor wasn't a reptile and it wasn't a mammal. It was this other thing, would have looked a little bit like a sort of newt, or perhaps superficially like a lizard, although it wasn't. And this is way back further than you might think. So this is right back at the dawn of like animals coming out of the water onto land. So really our lineage, if we want to look at our whole ancestry, it's been separate from everything else for a very, very long time. And there's lots of really bizarre creatures at different points in our history that have flourished, have sort of taken over the world for a while. And then of course there's a mass extinction and they all disappear. So if I had to pick my favorite point in mammal evolution, it would probably be actually before the dinosaurs, a time called the Permian. So this is 252 million years ago. And Britain and Ireland and Europe were squished in the center of this massive supercontinent. And there was deserts everywhere. And the world was populated with creatures that were like weirdly familiar and yet totally and utterly like nothing you've seen before. So like 3 meter long plant-eating giants that look like basically triangles with legs, huge chunky beefcakes. and they're walking over these sand dunes in what would of course later become Europe and the British Isles. So this is like a completely bizarre time period that very few people get to hear about, which is part of the reason I wanted to talk about it in this book and bring this story, bring this time period to life.
So our common ancestor with reptiles was a sort of lizardy but not quite lizard thing. What is the last common ancestor of mammals, do we know?
Of the living mammals?
Yeah.
Well, that is a difficult one to answer because we don't entirely know. We've got two lines of evidence. We can look at fossils and we can look at genes. The fossils, the oldest one is not very old, geologically speaking. When I say that it's like over 100 million years old, that's obviously quite old. But the genes suggest it's much, much older than that because we have an ancestor with platypuses and echidnas. So we're looking at least 160 million years ago in the Jurassic, but possibly older, possibly back to the very late Triassic. So that's 200 million years ago.
And that must have been one specific species, right? Did that species live in the water or did it live on land?
Definitely a land dweller. You're right that it would be one species, but we will just never know what species it is specifically.
It's kind of crazy to think about the fact that all mammals, the weird rainbow kaleidoscope of mammal life, all came from one type of creature and we don't know what that is.
It's pretty bonkers. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And we know so little about it. We can only kind of infer these things from genes and from fossils. And we can trace things like their genomes. We can trace them down through ancestry. But yeah.
So if we really didn't come from reptiles, did mammals ever lay eggs, or did that break off before mammals evolved into their own thing?
Yeah, they definitely laid eggs. For a long time in our history of our bigger family, we would have all been egg layers right back to the beginning. It's one of the defining features of the group that includes us and reptiles, is that we all lay eggs. So at what point some of us stopped is another one of the great mysteries. We don't know when we stopped laying eggs, and possibly multiple different family lines of mammals. Some of them stopped, other ones continued. Of course, platypuses and echidnas still lay them. Or maybe it just happened once all of a sudden in lots of groups. We have absolutely no idea because we don't have any fossil eggs and we can't tell from their bodies whether they were egg layers or not.
How do we not know from their bodies? Surely.
Yeah, you would think.
I mean, I would, you know, surely there's a big gap where the eggs go, but that's not exactly how it actually works, is it?
Well, so there are these funny little bones.
You can use a little child's diagram if you want to explain the really basics of boys and girls to me.
You would think it would be really obvious, but it really isn't. There's these funny little bones that some marsupials have got, some of the ones that have pouches have got in their hips. But we now know from looking across the sort of fossil record that those are not, they don't have them because they lay eggs. They have them for other reasons. So we actually, we don't really actually have the evidence. We can't tell from their bodies.
And in any fossil record, is it possible to tell whether or not these eggs, when they're laid, are always hard-shelled? I mean, that seems like a stupid question, but we lay eggs now, right, without hard shells. As humans, we create eggs, and they're kept within the body. Was there a transition there, or how did we get from presumably laying hard eggs to having live young within the womb?
Well, it's thought that our ancestors would have been laying softer eggs. So if you look at a lot of reptiles, they actually don't have a hard shell in their egg. Like, we think of eggs as being hard, but it's mainly birds that have that. Right. Most of them, it's like a leathery sort of tough coating on the outside. So probably our ancestors would have had that kind of covering on their eggs. And of course, something that soft is not going to preserve very well as a fossil. So that's why it's so incredibly rare to find anything like that.
Is that divergence to keeping that entire gestation thing inside, is that something that happened many times for mammals, like live birth, or was it just once over history? In other ways, some species evolve the same traits in geographically or chronologically different eras.
Well, in the mammals, the ones that have live birth now, it probably happened in one common ancestor that they all share. But if we look at actually reptiles, there are lots of different reptiles that have independently evolved live birth. So we do have reptiles that give birth to live young. And it's happened something like 24 different times in different reptiles. So if it happens that often in reptiles, I think it's pretty safe to say it probably happened more than once in the mammal line. But again, we just don't know because it doesn't preserve.
What about dolphins and whales? What can they tell us about mammalian evolution? Are they interesting because they came out of the water, evolved to be mammals, and then went back into the water? I mean, that is what happened, right?
That's absolutely okay. What happened. Well, of course, they weren't the first ones to do it. You might be familiar with, in the same period as dinosaurs, we have marine reptiles that did exactly the same thing. They came out on land and then they were really ungrateful and they went straight back into the sea again. So I think one of the main things that dolphins and whales can teach us is that things like that, like going back into the sea or flying in the case of bats, all these different things that we see in evolution, they happen again and again. We call it convergent evolution, and it just means basically the same thing cropping up repeatedly. And I think this is really one of the most important patterns in the natural world. There's like, what's the phrase? There's nothing new under the sun. I mean, really, there isn't. Everything we see in the world around us has been done before, and an awful lot of it got done first in the lineage that leads to us, that leads to mammals.
Can we infer from the fact that whales and dolphins managed to survive that transition and didn't go back to laying eggs, that there's something very advantageous to giving birth to live young? Or is that too much of a stretch?
I don't think those things really are related to one another. I mean, one thing I would pick up on is, so you're saying that they kind of survived that transition. But it's another really sort of important thing to highlight about evolution is that anything that any animal is doing at any time is always the absolute best thing for survival at that moment. Because if it wasn't, of course, they wouldn't survive. So the fact that they give birth to live young was probably useful in going back to the water, because we know that the marine reptiles that have done that, they also gave birth to live young. Because if you're laying eggs, but you can't come out on land, it's going to be really difficult to lay eggs because you're an air breather. So so giving birth to live young makes sense if you're an aquatic animal.
Do we know why platypuses ended up the way they did and kangaroos, it seems like such a strange adaptation when you look at all the other animals on planet Earth that they managed to retain. But I suppose that's evolution, right? That's making whatever you have work in your own ecological niche.
Absolutely. I think that platypuses and echidnas tend to get held up as these complete weirdos in the mammal world. But of course, if we had, you know, if science had been born in Australia, we would think they were pretty normal and regular and that lots of other animals were weird. So yeah, there's that. But they are, I should also caveat that by saying they are a bit unusual. I mean, they've got all kinds of bizarre things going on with their beak. You know, it's not beak, it's actually like a rubbery sort of appendage. Just superficially looks like a beak. You know, they've
it's
got
not a beak.
No, it's not a beak. It's got a bone inside it. If you look at a platypus skull, it kind of looks like a pincer. It's got this pincer shape.
And no.
The thing that looks like a hard beak is actually rubbery and kind of soft. And it's absolutely covered in little receptors that pick up electrical pulses in the water. So
oh
they
my
can
God.
Actually. Yeah. So
sorry,
when they're under.
Just if you haven't got access to Google, platypus's skull looks a little bit like, I'm going to say, General Grievous.
Like what's
it's a,
that?
Such from Star Wars. It's but like it has. It's not. It as you say. It looks like two sets of pincers on top of each other. They don't clearly don't move because it's a single bone. But really weird ass looking shape.
It is really weird. So in that way, they are unusual because we don't see that really in any other animal alive today. So it does make them strange. But of course, they come from an equally long line of relatives and ancestors that didn't have those strange beaks. So yeah, they're both unique, but also, you know, they're just doing what they do.
One of the things about people, I think, is that we like to organize ideas. And we have this idea that mammals evolved from something small and got bigger and bigger and bigger into the size they are today, which of course is actually completely untrue. We've ballooned and shrunk many times over many ice ages, right?
You're absolutely right. We came from small ancestors. We had lots and lots of large relatives. Then in the time of dinosaurs, became small again. And then in the last 66 million years, which is actually a very small amount of time, we've got massive animals again. But I think it's kind of interesting when we look at these sorts of patterns, because people think, you know, in the time of dinosaurs particularly, that mammals are small and that's seen as like a bad thing. Like, oh, you know, they were pretty rubbish because they were so tiny. But actually, most mammals on Earth today are tiny. They're really small. And this is not like a kind of, it's not that they're losing out by being small. They're more like microchips. I mean, they're properly honed little creatures. And in these adaptations to be little, they unlocked a lot of the anatomy that we have today. Mm-hmm. So that's it's actually just as good to be small as it is to be big. We should definitely expand our horizons when we think about that kind of thing.
A note for the children, I think. Dr. Elsa Panciaroli, author of Beasts Before Us, The Untold Story of Mammal Origins and Evolutions, out now. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.